Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Thrasher Opera House Presents. I'm Jason Mansmith, marketing director here at Thrasher Opera House, and joined by Riley Eisnagel, our production team lead. And Riley, we want to talk a little bit. I should say, first of all, how you doing?
Hey, I'm great today.
Good. I'm filling in for Rachel. So, you know, my demeanor, my presence, and my delivery is a little bit different.
I thought something looked a little different
Yeah, just a little bit today. So, we're excited because we're getting set for a really busy week coming up here at Thrasher, and especially the days of the 12th, the 13th, and 14th, as we have shows back-to-back-to-back with Roger McGuinn, and then two shows, a double shot, as I say, from Paul Thorne on Friday and Saturday.
Three sold-out shows in a row.
Right, and a Friday the 13th performance, which is always fun.
Right.
No superstition there.
Yeah, we're going to pretend that doesn't exist.
Exactly. Well, today, our friends over at Hometown Broadcasting were able to chat with Roger McGuinn. Wayne Mauser, the morning show guy on The Bug, was able to talk with Roger a few days ago, and we're going to bring that back here for you in just a matter of moments. But first, I want to talk about Roger McGuinn and just kind of the he's a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. With the Byrds, which is pretty impressive to be taking the stage here in Green Lake.
With good reason. He has writer and performer credits on songs that set the tone for a generation.
Tell me the first time you kind of heard about Roger McGuinn. How'd you get to learn about him?
Well, I knew the songs for a long time because we'd heard the songs many, many times on the radio and in other places as I was growing up. But learning about Roger McGuinn, really the first time I paid attention, frankly, was when I knew that he was going to be here at Thrasher. And then I put two and two together and said, oh, Roger McGuinn, these songs. This is a famous person who has a pedigree.
Just a tad bit of one.
Right.
I have a different story as to how I learned about Roger McGuinn.
Okay.
So as a child of this 70s and 80s, my parents always had the oldies station on, right? Okay. Always playing the oldies station. And I'd heard, you know, Turn, Turn, Turn and Mr. Tambourine Man.
Sure.
But my parents also were big fans of the Mamas and the Papas.
Okay.
All right. And they have a song called Creek Alley. And they go through all these lists of like these singers and performers in there. And one of them in the coffee house, Sebastian sat. And after every song, they passed the hat, and then it went McGuinn and McGuire just to get in higher in L.A., you know where that's at. And I was like, what is that all about? What is that all about? So John Sebastian was, you know, doing coffee shop gigs, passing around the hat.
Sure.
And the Mamas and the Papas were trying to just say how elevated Roger McGuinn of the Byrds and Barry McGuire, who wrote Eve of Destruction,
right,
were at that time in the music scene.
Sure.
So that's kind of how I learned about Roger McGuinn. At that time, wasn't, you know, named Roger McGuinn. You know, he had a name change. It's kind of an interesting story. I went deep on that.
I guess so.
Right? And that's the nerd that I am when it comes to the music sometimes.
That's why you're here as
right.
a marketing
yeah,
person.
Yeah, I guess so. But there's a lot of great songs. He's worked with some incredible artists, just a pedigree that's unbelievable.
Oh, he's done a tremendous amount. And yeah, you're right. He has a great pedigree, and we expect another excellent performance.
Yeah, that 12-string Rickenbacker kind of brought the, first kind of electric guitar into folk music with his, and, you know, oh yeah, played with David Crosby and the Byrds too, right?
I mean, does Rickenbacker give him royalties for doing so much for them?
I hope so, right? I would hope he's got a little coin coming that way from it for sure. Before I forget, also want everybody to make sure they join us on all of our socials to stay up to date on everything on our Facebook, Instagram. You can always check us out, Thrasher Opera House. We're getting closer to that 100 subscriber mark on YouTube. So if you haven't smashed that button to subscribe yet, do so now, and we can get into there. And then it's going to make it a whole lot easier. You can just search YouTube under Thrasher Opera House instead of QXW876432. Q94 or something like that, right? However it comes up.
We're looking forward to that.
Yeah, very much so. So we're going to step here and have Wayne talk to Roger McGuinn. Performance coming up next week, Thursday, at Thrasher Opera House. Now, tickets are sold out, but if you wanted to get on the wait list,
you can.
You could certainly do that. Give us a call here. Not guaranteeing you any tickets, but if any would free up. And the wait list, I'll be honest with you, is probably deep already, but
it's a long shot.
Yeah, but you know, there's a possibility of that.
That's right.
It's a real honor for me to be talking with Roger McGuinn, the frontman and leader of The Byrds, who had so many great songs. Roger, this is cool. Thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You know, I don't know where to start, except I know you were born and raised in Chicago, and you made a number of moves, going to the East Coast and Greenwich Village and making the move out to L.A. But those early years, describe your musical influences.
Well, it started back in 1956. I had a transistor radio, and I heard Elvis's Heartbreak Hotel, and it made me want to get a guitar and play rockabilly. I got into Gene Vincent and Carl Perkins and Johnny Cash and the Everly Brothers, and that was great. And then I was influenced by a guy named Bob Gibson, a folk singer in Chicago, and that took me over to the Old Town School of Folk Music, where I learned how to play the 5-string banjo and the 12-string guitar.
What kind of a 12-string was it? I heard you were influenced by George Harrison of the Beatles and his 12-string Rickenbacker.
Yeah, the Rickenbacker. But before that, I was an acoustic 12-string player. In fact, I was a studio musician in New York, and I was kind of the go-to guy for acoustic 12-string for a while. So I was into 12-string from the late 50s on, and I didn't know about electric 12-strings. And it was funny because folk singers didn't play electric guitars back when John Hall, F.C. Hall, invented the Rickenbacker electric 12-string. He was the owner of the company, Rickenbacker Company. And I got to talk to him. I said, why did you invent an electric 12-string? And he said, oh, I did it for the folk boom. And I said, but folk singers don't play electric guitars. And he just didn't know that or something.
Well, you were a sideman for the Limelighters, the Chad Mitchell Trio, Judy Collins, who played guitar and sang backup vocals for Bobby Darin. And that must have been an exciting time for you, too. I mean, learning the trade, so to speak.
Yeah, it was great. You know, I was given a lot of opportunities, and the good thing was I was prepared for them because I studied for several years at the Old Town School of Folk Music, and I had a good background in music. I knew how to harmonize, and I knew different chords and melodies, and I was capable of keeping along with lead sheets when I got to the studio, and so it was a good time.
Now, the Byrds were founded in 1964. Talk about leading up to that time and some of the people that you met. Of course, your band members, Gene Clark, David Crosby, Michael Clark, Chris Hillman. Talk a little bit about that and how you got formed and how you brought those people in.
I'm going to tell those stories in my show, but briefly, I was out in the West Coast. I was playing, opening up for Hoyt Axton, and Gene Clark came backstage, and he appreciated my love of the Beatles and folk music, and he said, let's write some songs, and we started doing that. Crosby came along and sang harmony, and he wanted to be in the band, and we got him in. And then we got Michael Clark and Chris Hillman, and we had a band. But, you know, then I'll tell the story of how we came up with a name for it, how we got a record deal, and how we got a hit single.
Well, Mr. Tambourine Man, a Bob Dylan song, was your first number one hit. You had two straight there with that, and Turn, Turn, Turn. The thing that just leaps out is that lick of Mr. Tambourine Man. How did you come about getting that? And, I mean, it's such a unique sound.
Well, if you listen to the lick, it's part of the melody of the song, but it's also, it coincides with Bach's Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring, which I knew how to play. I learned that from Pete Seeger. He did it on one of his records on the banjo, and I learned how to play it on the banjo, and then I figured it out on the guitar as well. So it's interesting that it coincides with the melody of Mr. Tambourine Man, the song, and Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring, the Bach piece.
And you released that before Dylan did, and then later, of course, Like a Rolling Stone was his first venture with an electric guitar, and it wasn't initially accepted by critics or his fans.
Right. He got booed for having a band and electric guitar. It was not something that the folk people liked. There was a big gulf between rock and roll and folk music back then, and they found it as a betrayal of their principles, you know, like, you know, you're selling out to the enemy going to rock and roll, but it worked out very well for him.
You worked with Simon and Garfunkel and Judy Collins and a lot of others. What was it like working with these aspiring artists like yourself?
Well, I worked for Paul Simon. He invited me in to do the demo of Sound of Silence, and it was just another 12-string acoustic gig for me because I was doing quite a few of them in New York. And so I didn't know Paul Simon. They were called Tom and Jerry at the time, and I didn't know anything about him or what they were going to become. And I recorded the song, and I totally forgot about it until I was watching, I guess it was YouTube, and there was Paul Simon talking about, he wrote a book some years ago, and he was on a book tour talking about how he hired me to play the 12-string acoustic on the demo of Sound of Silence. I went, wow, I forgot about that. But Judy Collins, I knew who she was. I'd seen her in concert and so on. I was a big fan. And when she invited me to be musical director on her third album for Elektra, I was thrilled. It was just the greatest thing in the world.
Do you remember how many takes it took you to record Mr. Tambourine Man?
Mr. Tambourine Man was a composite of the Wrecking Crew with me and then the vocals from the other birds. So it only took a three-hour session to record Mr. Tambourine Man and I Knew I'd Want You, which was the flip side of the single. So these guys were pros, and that was why they hired them, because studio time was very expensive, and they didn't want to waste a lot of it on a fledgling band that really didn't know how to play that well. So it was about a three-hour session. And then when we recorded Turn, 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 the band all got to play on their own tracks after that because they lobbied for it, and they were very upset that the Wrecking Crew was on Mr. Tambourine Man. So it took 77 takes to get Turn, Turn, Turn.
Oh, my goodness.
I think over five days or something like that.
That was written by Pete Seeger. Of course, the verse, the lyrics from the book of Ecclesiastes out of the Bible.
From Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verses 1 through 8. Ralph Emery, I was on his TV show once, and he said, "Now, Roger, where in the Bible would I find this turn, turn, turn? I'd like to go home and read my Bible and see where it is." And I said, "It's in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, Ralph."
Great story from Roger McGuinn. I'll have part two of the interview tomorrow. But Roger McGuinn appearing at the Thrasher Opera House in Green Lake on May 12th. It's time for part two of my interview with Roger McGuinn, frontman and founder of The Byrds. Yesterday we talked about his early days, and of course they hit it big with Mr. Tambourine Man, and then followed that up with Turn, Turn, Turn. You had two straight number one singles. What were you guys thinking at the time, and how did your lives change?
It changed very slowly because we were kind of on the street. I was taking buses to get to rehearsal. I didn't have a car. And I remember when Mr. Tambourine Man became a hit, I heard cars going by with their car radio playing the song, and I was still walking. And I was going, something wrong with this picture. But, it takes a while for the income to spool up after you get a hit record. So you don't get anything right away. So it took a while. And it was a great feeling to hear it on the radio.
That song has played millions of times. We play retro music, kind of classic rock as well in our format, so it's always a thrill, such a great tune. Turn, 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 again, that was a number one hit. You had 8 Miles High, that went to number 14. You're starting to evolve a bit as a group. Tell us about, the next couple of years, what you went through before you released 8 Miles High.
Well, we didn't want to get locked in a box. The folk rock label was a box, and we started experimenting with John Coltrane and Ravi Shankar, and that's what happened with 8 Miles High. We had a tape in our bus. We were touring in the States, and we listened to Ravi Shankar on one side and John Coltrane on the other, and it kind of influenced us by the time we got back to L.A. to record.
Some of the rock stations around the country did not play that song as much just because they thought it was, a drug-related song.
Yeah, I tell that in my show. It's the radio guys did the math, and they said, wait a minute, commercial airliners don't fly 8 Miles High. They must be talking about some other kind of high. But it really wasn't a drug song. It was about an airplane ride over to England and back for a tour we did where we met the Beatles and the Rolling Stones.
Wow, what a great time that must have been. And, of course, they had made their pilgrimage to the East by that time, too, right in that time period, right?
Right. Well, we kind of turned George Harrison on to Ravi Shankar. We were at a party in a rented house in California, and David Crosby and I were into Ravi Shankar because he was an artist on World Pacific Records, and Jim Dixon, our manager, was a producer engineer at World Pacific. So we had access to Ravi's stuff. George had never heard of Ravi Shankar the first time we told him.
So the Byrds ended after a few years. It's always a difficult time, and especially for a lot of groups, you've got your run, and then all of a sudden, for whatever reason, you're through. How difficult a time was that?
Well, it was 1973, and David Geffen of Asylum Records wanted to do an album with the original five Byrds, and we did. And it didn't do very well, so I figured it was time to put the brand name away and go out solo, which I've always wanted to do. But even when I was a kid, I'd go to Pete Seeger concerts, and Pete had been in the Weavers, and I used to go to Weavers concerts. And when Pete split off from the Weavers, I was skeptical that he'd be able to pull it off all by himself, but I went to his concert at Orchestra Hall in Chicago, and he was amazing. He had several instruments, and he got the audience singing in three-part harmony, and I meant, man, that's what I want to do when I grow up.
Couple of quick things here. Solo version of The Ballad of Easy Rider, that was in the film Easy Rider. Talk about that a little bit.
Okay, well, I tell this story in my show, so I don't want to give away the cookie, but basically, Peter Fonda wanted a song written for the movie. He showed it to Bob Dylan. Bob suggested that I finish the song, and I did.
You had a groundbreaking album before that. It was called Sweetheart of the Rodeo. I know you're going to be talking about that and other things, too. I'm curious about that song. What was it about?
Okay, Sweetheart of the Rodeo. It was based on a poster, an old Western poster that we got. It was all country songs, and we were sincerely trying to do country music. We weren't making fun of it or anything like that. So it was a breakthrough for a rock band to go country like that. A lot of the rock fans didn't appreciate it, and the country fans didn't either, so it kind of fell through the cracks. Later, it was considered one of the best albums the Byrds ever did.
How quickly fans turn on you, right?
Yeah, well, we let them down. You know, they were expecting a certain sound and feel, and they didn't get it.
You have 10 solo albums to your credit. What's been the most fun for you since the breakup?
Well, I was doing a lecture, and one of the students asked me, what was the best thing you ever did in show business? And I said, leave it. So I'm kind of under the radar. I do concerts in theaters, and I really have a great time. It's an intimate setting. It's like being in somebody's living room, and it's the most fun for me to have a live concert in a theater.
Around 2000, you spoke at a congressional hearing about the royalties that a lot of the early artists didn't get. How important was that to change things a bit?
Well, things have changed. Sony Music gives us royalties now that we weren't getting, say, in the 80s. So it's all turned around. This was back when Napster was new and people were getting free music. And I said, hey, man, it's a new radio. It's like radio. It gets you, publicity. It gets your song out there. People hear it and want to come to your concerts and buy other things. So I told that to the Senate, and that was some 21 years ago.
You're playing at the Thrasher Opera House on May 12th, and you've played there before. What makes that such a great venue?
Well, they're all, all these theaters and performing arts centers that have been refurbished, and they're all pretty and comfortable for people. I think that's the best thing. The audience feels comfortable in a setting like that.
Will you be by yourself, or are there other musicians with you?
I'll be solo. It's a one-man play, basically. I tell the story of how I got into music and the people I met along the way, and they all tie together, all the stories tie together, setting up the different songs.
I know your faith is very important to you, and that's influenced you a lot, hasn't it?
Yes. I accepted Jesus in 1977 after Elvis Presley died. He was 7 years older than I was, and I went, man, I better get straight. So I I got straight with Jesus.
Well, you've been living the dream for your whole life. You'll be at the Thrasher Opera House on May 12th. Roger McGuinn of the Byrds. Thank you so much, and all the best.
Thank you very much.